Welcome to AI in Journalism. I'm Yumi Wilson, a journalism professor, branding expert, and your host. In this podcast, we'll boldly explore the intersection of AI and journalism, from its origins to its implications for newsrooms. We'll discuss the symbiosis of AI and human judgment, ethical concerns, and most importantly, arm you with the knowledge to navigate this brave new world. Whether you're a budding journalist, seasoned editor, or simply an AI enthusiast, join us as we fearlessly uncover the future of journalism in the age of artificial intelligence. Welcome to AI in Journalism.
Imagine being a journalist in Cuba, dealing with constant threats, harassment, and even exile. All for telling the truth. Despite it all, you keep going, using AI and other tech to shine a light on what's really happening. Today, we're talking to Jose Hassan Nieves Cardenas, the editor-in-chief of El Toque, an independent Cuban media outlet pushing the boundaries of journalism under intense government repression. Even from exile, Jose and his team relentlessly fight to inform the public and challenge the status quo. Jose and his team have not just survived, but thrived, using AI to expose the truth about Cuba's economy and more. Even in exile, the threats are real, but Jose's commitment to independent journalism doesn't falter. Today, we'll dive into how El Toque uses AI to outsmart government censors, the innovative ways they engage with their audience, and the daily dangers Jose faces. This is about courage, technology, and the fight for truth. Jose, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with El Toque's use of AI. How has it been in tracking the black market exchange rates in Cuba and reaching those who might not even have internet access?
Well, this is so far our most impactful work. We just found out in 2021 that there was an increasing need of information regarding the informal exchange rate market in Cuba, because there's not such things like a legal market of currency exchange. The state controls all the banks, and the banks were not selling foreign currency. So people needed that, and they started to sell and buy in the informal exchange market. And we were also seeing how people were like moving their practices from the physical world to the social media world to offer their money. We use AI to get all that information. We just scrap all the messages, and using natural language processing techniques, which is one of the options and techniques of the AI, we started to process that information and transform the simple messages into data. So we were able to get reference values, and we started to calculate a median value in real time of the values that the people were offering in the last 24 hours. And that became like a reference source of information for the Cuban people. Because even though around 60% of the Cuban population is connected to internet, the other part, which is not connected to internet, they also have ways to get the information, because probably they are not connected to internet, but they do have a smartphone without internet. So people share that through other ways using Bluetooth. So we got our information processed by AI, and we started to create like communicative products with that, like graphics for social media. And we shared our data in the form of a photo, so that people can later reshare that through semi-offline hybrid forms to their partners or family inside Cuba. So, as I said, transformational product that move us from a niche media serving very few Cuban people, like 30,000 people per month, to a very well-known media with around 1 million monthly users, 85% of them coming from Cuba.
That is amazing. Let's just back up a little bit. How did you come up with this idea? How did you galvanize people to do this work and, you know, to grow?
I have the very enormous luck to have a very creative team. And part of the team is people, developers, software engineers, Cuban software engineers that are really smart, because we have to outperform not only the Cuban government barriers, but also the U.S. embargo barriers. So they are always finding ways to avoid or circumvent censorship and to create like practical solutions to solve our daily life problems. So I came with this concern to my development director, a Cuban engineer now living in Ecuador. And I told him, hey, Abraham, look, people are just buying and selling money in these social media groups. I know these previous experiences from Venezuela or Argentina, where there are also an informal market, and they have these references, media becoming references. How can we become the Cuban reference? And he was, okay, you know, I'm a very AI enthusiast, so I think that if we use natural language processing techniques, we can process that messages and transform it into data. And that was possible also because he has been working on AI since 2 to 3 years before we came up with this idea. He was testing chatbots for our audience during the pandemic, the COVID pandemic. He developed a chatbot that was able to read messages that the people sent us through WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, or Telegram, asking questions regarding the COVID. And we had like a database behind with articles answering those questions. So using natural language processing techniques, he was able to partner like the question of the people with the most approximate correct answer. And also it's a very interesting thing because the people can say to us, okay, this answer really answered my question or not, it's not correct. So we improve the mechanism. So this experience we have had regarding AI paved the way to develop this exchange rate service that become like the beacon service. And I think we got a very good timing. People just simply needed that information because there was no information. There was no reference. And of course, with something so sensitive like the money of the people, they wanted to have something, a reference to negotiate and to really evaluate their money. So it's helpful for sellers because they can put a price according to what the market is considering, but also for the buyers because they have a reference to avoid scams or overpricing. So it's a really simple but practical solution. And then we started to see how people that were running restaurants in Cuba were using that reference rate in their menus. We have seen like taxi drivers dealing with tourists, and just in a way to show that they are not robbing, they were saying, hey, this is the reference rate in real time. So the rate I'm taking for you is the one according to the real exchange rate. So that gave us a lot of confidence from the people, of course. We have been all the time working to be transparent in order to earn that confidence and that trust.
Given the community and the public reaction, all sounding positive, all based on trust and credibility, what about the government's reaction?
Well, you know, that's the best reference of impact we have. When you have the prime minister of the Cuban government saying in front of the National Congress that they have to shut down that service, which is putting the price of the dollar from a foreign computer, you know, they are talking about you. It's something that in some point you say, are these people serious? Do they know how this works? Because of course the Cuban government have tried to transform us into a scapegoat of their failures. For many people in Cuba, it's easier to relate a graphic social media photo that each day says that the money is at this rate, instead of to understand that the reason of why the Cuban money is devaluating is because lack or bad policies from the government. So the government strategy regarding us has been changing in the last 2 years. At the beginning, we were completely invisible, you know, they just simply doesn't talk about us. We were not existing. Once we became the reference, then they started to attack us using their propaganda apparatus, which is very hegemonic in Cuba. They control all the state, all the radios, TV, newspapers, and they allow websites working from within Cuba. So they use their entire propaganda apparatus to start to generate distrust in the people. Don't believe in these people. They are not serious. They don't have a methodology. This is just a CIA operation to intervene in the Cuban economy. And they then started to attack our team in the field. During 2022, we have a team of 20 people working from Cuba. And they were really public. They have a Telegram group where they were all hanging out. They were having parties in the beach. Cuba is a tropical island, so you may imagine it's a really nice place to go to the beach. But it was a vulnerability, we found out, because the Cuban state police, which is the political police, is an arm of the state security apparatus in charge of ideological things, you know. And they started to look after these people, our people, and started to detain them, banning them from leaving the country, started exposing them in national television as personalities, CIA conspirators, and threatening them to go to jail. So we lost our entire team in that year, in a matter of weeks, we think Cuba. But the system was in place outside Cuba, so we were able to keep operating with the people that was outside Cuba. So after that, situation keeps deteriorating. The Cuban peso has been devaluating all months after month, and they started to attack us again this year, 2024. But this time they hit up the attack, and they started to use like concerted campaigns in social media. We were able to track 2,300 users at the same time in social media, Facebook and Twitter, attacking us. It's like a network of people they have, trolls, to contaminate the public space. And also, they started to ask them to start to publish fake offers in the social media groups we were monitoring, because that was the way they had to intervene our system. So they started to publish fake offers, fake numbers, in order to move down the value of the calculation we were made. Of course, we were prepared for that. We have filters, we have a methodology. We were monitoring all the situation, detecting this kind of trolls and let them out of the system. But it was like 2 months of really a lot of uncertainties, instabilities, and the people started to just be concerned about us. But at the end, we were able to keep the system afloat, coherent with what was happening in the real market, so the people still trusting us. We are still having their confidence. But the last issue was that the Cuban government, seeing that this strategy wasn't working, decided to move forward with another attack. So they started to threaten me personally. They sent somebody to pass by the front of my house. They filmed that, and they sent that video in a WhatsApp message to me, saying, "We know where you are. We will have to go after you." So you have to take this kind of threat really seriously. And I made a report with the FBI. I publicly denounced it too. So far, I haven't received any new threat, but this is just a new chapter of this really difficult relation we have, the Cuban government and El Toque. Because, of course, they don't want that we keep publishing this information. Because it, for us, it's not only an information service, it's a transparency effort. We are bringing light to a place where darkness is the common reality.
I just have to take a moment and imagine what it would be like to be essentially harassed because you're doing what I believe is good journalism. And I wonder, how is that pressure on you every day? And how do you manage to keep pushing and keep going, knowing that there is really such a threat to your safety?
The main concern is not regarding my personal security, about my family. You know? I have two small children, a daughter and a boy, and they were the reason I left Cuba in 2019. Before then, I was able to deal with the risk of even go to prison for what I was doing. But once they appeared, I was no longer willing to sacrifice them. So when you see that these people, from these agents from the Cuban government, starting to threat your kids in a safe place, which should be the U.S., is something really concerning. So far, I believe the Cuban government is just threatening. It's just that. It's not enough to stop. And what keeps me moving forward is, first of all, well, my family. They are really well aware of what I'm doing. And it's not only my direct family, which is my wife and my children, but also our Cuban extended family, which is grandmothers, cousins, sister, brothers. It's a huge amount of people. They are all well aware of what I'm doing, and they are proud of that. The second thing is my colleagues. I have a really good team of people. We are about 30 people working from 10 different countries. We had to go to exile, all of us, for what we were doing. And this is the way we keep connected with our own country, and we keep serving our home country. So they are really capable people, intelligent, smart, creative. This kind of solution, I could have an idea, but the way they implement it or the way they suggest we can do new things is just mind-blowing. I'm always really proud of them. And the third one is the Cuban people itself. Because, yes, we do have a lot of enemies and we do have a lot of critics. And they are talking whatever you can imagine about me. I'm a mercenary, I'm a CIA agent. One day I'm that, the other day I'm a Cuban agent because I'm just not critic enough to criticize the Cuban dictatorship, because as a journalist, I want to be objective. I want to try to show all the faces of a problem. Well, for some radical people, it's not enough because I'm not like a human rights activist. In some way, I'm a human rights activist, but I'm a journalist first. But besides that, you see, there are a lot of people using us. And also letting us to know they are following us, using our services, and they are thankful for that.
Speaking of journalism, this brings me to my next question. Your project La Cuba KVNA won a prestigious award for explanatory reporting. It used a transmedia approach to inform the public about Cuba's constitutional reform. Can you share more about how you made this complex political content engaging and accessible, especially in such a controlled media environment?
I think that we were young and we were eager to test a lot of things and to push all the preconceptions we have had regarding the way we should talk about politics. This is a transmedia project, but the origin is a simple comparison between the draft of a new constitution that the Cuban government was presenting to the Cuban people in 2018, and the constitution at the time. So two legal experts came to us with this analysis in an Excel sheet, you know, and they say, hey, we did this. We compare each article they are proposing with the ones that are in place. And we found out this is really interesting to see what they are changing, what they are including, what they are erasing. And it was like, oh, wow. But digital technologies and multimedia tools allow us to do that in a very playful way, if you like, in a very didactic way to engage people to do that thing these experts did by themselves. So we developed kind of a tool that people can use to see these changes, to understand what was happening. And that was just the start of a like a snowball running down a hill. Because then somebody else proposed, hey, what about if we detect how many times the new draft of the Constitution says the future law will regulate? Because that's a typical solution that the Cuban government uses to avoid to put something in the Constitution and let posterior laws. So they avoid that, just putting this phrase, the future law will regulate. And they a future law probably will be unconstitutional because the limits they will put in the law are above the limits that the Constitution itself proclaims, but that's the kind of thing. So when we started to do that, we detected 100 times that the Cuban new constitution was saying the future law was regulated. And it was like, hey, look how these people are just avoiding to compromise themselves in anything regarding human rights or stuff like that. And then we started to see, okay, let's follow how are the media and the people in the internet talking about this constitution. And we made like a discourses analysis, and we were able to see what were the words that were concerning the most to the people. And then we started to do like physical events. We got the support of the Catholic Church in Cuba because they had like a gray zone where they can host events, critical events of the political system under the protection of the church. So we went there and we organized these public gatherings in Havana to talk about the new constitution. We filmed that, then we distributed through YouTube. Something really funny happened to one of our colleagues. He was one of the lawyers talking about this reform in one of these videos. And one day he took a taxi, and the taxi driver told him, hey, I know you. And he said, no, you don't know me. I don't know who you are. You are the one, the lawyer that was talking about the reform. I was saying this and this. Yes, that was me. Where did you see me? In a video. Because in Cuba, even though the people doesn't have full access to internet, as I mentioned before, there are something called the weekly package. It's a weekly digital package of information. It's like a hard drive of 1 terabyte of digital information with videos, soap operas, movies, software, digital PDF magazines that is moving around the entire island. And the people that doesn't have real-time access to internet get this kind of 1 week after internet. There's a delayed internet because everything you can find on internet, they download it and put it in this hard disk of 1 terabyte of information and starting to distribute it through all over the island. So we published this video on YouTube. Somebody downloaded it and included it in the weekly package and started to move through the island in these hard disk pen drives, sharing using Bluetooth from one device to another. So that's the way you distribute information in this hybrid scenario of Cuba. So La Cuba Que Viene was a wonderful test of how much we could talk about difficult things in multimedia formats, transmedia approaches. And well, I think we were lucky enough to win this online journalism award in 2019 because frankly speaking, I believe it was worth it. You know, it was such an effort with so high impact.
I had a chance to look at some of the way that it's laid out, and it's very, very interactive. And I'm wondering if what happened as a result of you putting this information out about how many changes would be happening, what was the end result?
Well, the Constitution was approved. We never expected that to be approved, and we were not doing campaign. And we cannot talk about data of how many people changed their opinion. It was a really interesting scenario where the people were, for the first time in so many times, in so many years, just discussing publicly without the control or the limits that the state propaganda was trying to move the conversation. Right? Propaganda was trying to focus on the new rights that should be included for example, the equal marriage was something that was included in that constitution. It was a real positive step. But we were focused more, okay, look, in this constitution, the Communist Party is above the state. There's an article that says that the Communist Party is above all controls. So you should look at that. When you decide your vote, you should be looking at it. We were doing like support activity for the debate. This was 2019. 2 years later, we had the biggest protest in Cuba in 60 years. July 11, 2021 was the moment that tens of thousands of people went to the street to protest. Until that moment, the Cuban image was that everybody was in favor of the system. And that day we saw that the real thing was, but we knew it. Most of the people are against the communist model, but they weren't saying. They were just seeing, reading, hearing people that were brave enough to communicate their dissent. And I believe we were a small part of that contribution to the political activation of the citizenship.
So since 2019, and certainly since 2021, when this large protest happened, what are some of the other projects that you have been working on and really kind of built up on since you did that first project with the interactive and the transmedia quality to it?
Indeed. La Cuba que viene was like the starting point, and then we found out that there was an opportunity for us to talk about legal things, laws, in a friendly way to the users. Cuban people want legal education because part of the paternalistic approach of the Cuban communist system is you don't need to know your rights. We are in charge of that. So we need to challenge that narrative. We need to start to say to people, look, you need to understand the laws. To change the law, you need to first understand the law. And you need to know your rights. Or you need to know that you don't have rights. And that's the kind of work we have been doing with legal education. We have a unit of legal education. We call it Legalis. And it's like a vertical of the El Toque brand. It's El Toque Jurídico, which in Spanish, something like El Toque Legal. So we developed a complete platform to facilitate the access to legal information. Because what we were seeing is that the people were having a hard time just finding the laws because the Cuban equivalent to the Federal Register is not friendly, not searchable. So we developed like a parallel Federal Register. We download all the legal norms of Cuba in PDF. We upload it to a new platform and we made it more accessible. People can search using keywords and stuff like that and find the law they are looking for. But also included other services like a dictionary, legal terms. So, because the Cuban, one of the practices of the Cuban government is take a concept of the Western world and leave it without meaning and put a new meaning in a socialist way. So if you see some representative of the Cuban government in the United Nations, you probably will hear them say, we have something like habeas corpus for people detained in Cuba. But when you go to the Cuban legislation and you see what is considered habeas corpus in Cuban legislation, is nothing related with what the Western world understands is a habeas corpus. So this kind of tactic, we have to dismount it using this dictionary of Cuban legal terms. So you can understand clearly what the Cuban government is meaning when they are saying things like habeas corpus. So we are also doing that in legal. After that, we also created this chatbot. So we have been working with chatbots to counter misinformation. We created the exchange rate service. And well, we have been testing with data journalism, creating our own databases to cover information that is not provided by the government. It doesn't have the impact of the exchange rate service, but it is a really impactful work from my point of view. We created a database following public reports of death and disappearance of Cuban migrants coming from Cuba to the US using different routes through the sea to the Florida Keys, or the land corridors through Central America to the southern border. And we found out that in 5 years, more than 400 Cubans have died and more than 600 Cubans have disappeared in this route. And we didn't want just to put the numbers there. So we started to get the identities of these people, because those numbers are people and they had history and family. So we create like a memorial of the Cuban migrants that died in the route to reach the US. And that kind of thing is data journalism at the end, because when we were gathering a database using reports from media in each of these countries, or somebody in social media posting, my son is missing since took to the sea this day. And we want also to use this as a memorial to keep the memory of these people alive, also as a tool to help to find people disappear, because disappearance are people that haven't been found, so you're still looking for them. And once you make it public, you probably can use your bigger reach to distribute that information and help to find somebody. And also as a data journalist that shows the tragic dimension of the Cuban migrant crisis in the last 5 years.
That's a lot that's going on. And so my question is, and as you probably know, I mean, as journalists, anyone trying to start a new project, anyone trying to do data journalism, it usually comes down to a cost, you know, cost of money, resources. How have you been able to gather the funds, you know, needed to make these amazing projects happen?
I would like to say that we have been able to do that making a lot of sacrifices, because we are not getting the money this kind of work deserves. But well, our main source of incomes are grants. We have been able to operate thanks to contributions made possible through grants from some agencies in the US, like federal programs, promotion of human rights in Cuba, but also funds from international cooperation agencies from Europe and Canada, but also working with international donors such as Open Society Foundation. That's the main bulk of our budget, which, by the way, has been increasing. Each time that somebody left the island, is your budget goes from one value to 3x, 4x the value of that people. So we have seen how our budget has grown in the last years, and that has supposed a lot of more effort to find that money to keep the operations afloat. But that's why we also developed like a parallel income source revenue model. So we transform our entire organization in an agency, providing services to their clients. So our designers are not only designing graphics for us, but also designing services to clients. Our social media team is not only managing our media, social media profiles, but also managing or creating strategies, marketing strategy in social media, for example, international cooperation agencies or civil society organizations. My financial director is not only taking care that we are compliant and we got through all the audits, but also she is helping to implement financially programs to other organizations, the smaller organizations that doesn't have a financial department. So we are like partners or some grantors that want to benefit small organizations that doesn't have strong operations system. We use our operation system to support smaller publishers or content creators to get the funds that some grantors have for them. So everybody in the organization has a role generating money for the organization, besides the core funding that comes from grants. And now we are also expanding our revenue strategy to involve more and more our fellow Cubans in exile. That Cuban diaspora could be really helpful and transformational into supporting us with a small donations, like a typical donation membership program, subscription program. You are starting to develop some ideas in that sense, because right now, only in the US, there are more than 1.5 million QAs, and 600,000 of them just arrived in the last 3 years. And those that just recently arrived know us from their time in Cuba. They know we are a trusted source of information from them. They are still using our information because they want to keep connected with what is happening in Cuba. So we are starting to develop products that serve the information needs of Cuban American community in order to also be helpful, meaningful for the Cubans living in the U.S. And then we can reach out to them and say, hey, help us to keep running this way. If I can resume, my strategy is a mix of diversified grantors, also commercial incomes from services to third parties, and also real revenue strategies such as membership, so small donations.
I think that's a great business strategy that many of us can try to emulate. I want to ask you a little bit about your current role, if this is correct, as the ICFJ Knight Fellow. And let me just define, if just for listeners, the International Center for Journalists. Knight Fellowships are prestigious positions that support journalists who are driving innovations in reporting, storytelling, and newsroom practices around the world. So first of all, congratulations. And second, tell us all about it. How did you find out about it? What is it helping you to do?
Well, it's a prestigious, indeed, fellowship. I have been an admirer, and also I have been following the work of International Center for Journalists regarding Cuba in years before. And I just saw this opportunity. It's an open call. They open each year just to work. One of the topics was media in exile. So we are a media in exile. And for me, one of my main focus right now is how to make sustainable a media in exile. It's not only a discussion about how to make sustainable a media, but also a media in exile, which has its own characteristics. So I saw an opportunity there. I was in that moment in a fellowship with CUNY, the J School, the Craig Newmar School of Journalism of CUNY in New York, an executive leadership in news innovation program. It's a wonderful transformational program. And I saw the ICFJ Knight Fellowship as an opportunity to keep working on what was my capstone project for the CUNY Fellowship, which is how we made sustainable media in exile. So I presented this project, and luckily for me, they found it interesting, and they are supporting me this year to develop tools, resources, information to support media in exile find their own way to sustainability. But what I decided to do was not coming here as a guy who knows everything, because what I have, most of everything in life, is questions. So I have a lot of questions because I don't have solutions. I have been able to pay each month salary of my team, but I don't consider that sustainability. If you follow what the Lion Publishers organization defines as sustainability for media, is the combination of financial health, operational resilience, and journalistic impact. If you have journalistic impact, but you don't have financial health, you are broke. If you have financial health and journalistic impact, but you don't have operational resilience, you are in the brink of being burned out because you don't have processes, you don't have policies, you don't have clear systems of functioning, and your people are probably at the brink of the burnout. So you have to balance all three things to be sustainable. I believe that's the goal, the objective. I am just talking with a lot of people, colleagues like me, media in exile, executives, to understand how are they doing their jobs, how are they finding solutions. And I have found a lot of creative ways to deal with this challenge, and a lot of humble and really open people that wants to share. They have learned, or they are learning, to other people, so to avoid that we duplicate efforts or just suffer the problems that other people are suffering also in their routes and pathway to sustainability.
So to understand this a little more, in terms of your project, you're working with journalists from different countries to figure out how to make folks who are working in exile, how can they sustain those businesses, those business models, those newsrooms, essentially, to get information back to their communities?
Indeed. That's correct. We all share a common challenge. Grant money is the main source of incomes for our media, but it's not enough. And it has a lot of vulnerabilities, and it has a lot of problems. So everybody needs to diversify their income sources. And what they are doing to diversify the income sources is the interesting thing, because I have found like 10 different business models as a way to generate incomes. For example, training programs, merchandising stores, exhibitions, memberships, political risk reports, commercial agencies. So people are testing a lot of ways to get money at the end, which is the goal, to sustain their operations. And I have been also able to find that there's like not very well covered issue regarding the human resource management. We need to talk about policies to keep our teams healthy and afloat. And media in exile, because it conditions and the bigger challenges that are political risk or security risk or how you relocate yourself to a new country and stuff like that, often forgot to discuss about maternity leave, holidays, social security policies and insurances. So that's something we need to start to talk more often, field of media in exile, because it's a very important component, which is operational resilience, that will be able to contribute to the sustainability of our efforts.
When you see yourself in the future, thinking about El Toque, your own life, the lives of the people you work with, where do you see things going in the next 2 to 5 years?
We started to talk about our new strategic plan. Where do we want to be in 2028? I would like to see at that time a media, El Toque, that is able to operate in a sustainable way. And that will include that we'll be able to operate without any person of the organization. Because right now, this is still a media really dependent on people, the people that have been able to run the organization in the last 7 years. I believe, of course, that if one of us cannot keep working in the organization, it's not the end. Of course, we will be able to survive, but it's going to be a bumpy ride right now. So what we are working is to create the conditions for smooth transitions. People can enter and leave roles without trauma and in the organizational level, I see. And even if a figure like me, which is, of course, the executive director, is the one in charge of most of the things. I'm the fundraiser, I'm the editor-in-chief. I'm doing a lot of work at the same time. I wear a lot of hats at the same time. If the organization is in a position that I can leave the organization and everything is going to keep running, that's the measure that the organization is mature and ready to move forward or is sustainable. It doesn't mean I will leave El Toque. I don't want to. I will love to keep working in El Toque for many years to come because we have a lot of ideas that I would love to see develop and how they will result in more impactful journalism. I have a lot of hypotheses that I would love to test, how a media in exile can impact within their home countries from outside. I would like to demonstrate that the media in exile can be sustainable, also financially speaking, from a mix of revenue income sources, that the diasporas and exile communities of each country can be transformational supporting media in exile. I have a lot of hypotheses test, but the most important thing for me will be this organization ready to operate without me. That's the measure of success.
I would agree with that assessment in terms of being a visionary. I mean, to me, it sounds like you're being a visionary in the sense that you see something that is working, that is helping people, and you know that it's not just one individual. It's really creating systems and tools that can be around no matter what, no matter what changes happen. I think that's a really good thing. As we wrap things up, tell us how we can reach out, how we can support, how we can get involved. If people are listening and they want to get involved, how can they do that?
The first thing is to follow us. We don't publish in English, and I really want to thank all the users that have been accompanying us today for bearing with me and my English. I'm based in South Florida, so we don't need to speak English here. In the U.S., I start a little far north here. In all our social media, we have in almost all the social media, we have a very nice YouTube channel. We translate the, we add subtitles to our videos in English. So if you are an English speaker, you can understand and get our products. And well, we are a nonprofit 501c3 organization registered in Florida, Mass Mozart Foundation. We have a donate button on the website, so somebody feels can help out. It's always welcome. We are very simple.
Well, on that note, I want to thank Jose Nieves for joining me today on AI in Journalism. And if you want to learn more, as Jose mentioned, eltoque.com is the place to go. I will provide show notes with a lot of these links that we talked about today. Until the next time, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, leave us a review, and stay curious.
Thanks for listening to AI in Journalism. If you liked what you heard, please hit that subscribe button. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn to share your thoughts and suggest future topics or even guests. And remember to always keep questioning and keep growing.